Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the richest nation in the world when we come back. Well, Charles Lyell, one of the pillars of modern geology, published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. And Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe every day back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. Now, this process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. That was a Newswire report. And it made the surprising statement, the sun is shrinking. The sun's diameter appears to have decreased by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years now, and the evidence is conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. Then, if we go back just 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. Now, as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaur extinction? Do you remember that story? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? Well, if the dinosaurs were exterminated or extinguished 65 million years ago, and only 20 million years ago, the sun would have been touching the Earth's surface. You know, we don't have to be rocket scientists to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And that's one more of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we conduct twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page and you can download it right there off of our website. That's georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page. All right, we've been talking about the richest nation in the world. What nation in the world is the richest, and is it the United States of America? And if it isn't the United States of America, can you point to them? And what happened to the United States of America, which at one time was the wealthiest, most powerful military, social, economic, and political power in the world? What's happened to that power? What's happened to that edge or that advantage? Well, last time we took a look and we said, could the nation live 3 years without any income? Well, the richest nation in the world could, and we learned that in Leviticus 25, verses 4, 10, and 21. Now, the richest nation in the world should have a nearly zero crime rate. We saw that in Deuteronomy 7, verses 8 through 13. We should have nearly a zero birth defects rate. We saw that in Deuteronomy 28, verses 4 and 6. We would lend but not borrow. We would have no banks, no insurance companies, no stock and bond markets. So let's take a look and think about this for a minute. What happens when you have banks in your land? Well, those banks issue paper money. Banks are in the business of lending paper money, making notes, mortgages, selling stocks and bonds, dealing in commercial paper. And so the average guy would say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, listen to this. Our founding fathers, people like George Washington and George Mason and Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton and others, we call those the founding fathers. You know, the people that signed our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and fought the war for the Revolution, or the War of the Revolution. Well, George Washington, our first president, had something to say about this. And in his circular letter of June 1783 to the governors of the several United States, he wrote that honesty will be found on every experiment to be the best and only true policy. Have you ever heard that term, that honesty is the best policy? Did you ever wonder, well, who thought of that? Who was the guy that thought that up? Well, there it is, George Washington. And then he wrote that in a letter in June of 1783 to the governors of the several states. Being convinced that arguments deduced from this topic could with pertinency and force be made use of against any attempt to procure a paper currency. Washington in 1783 was warning the governors against creating or procuring a paper currency. In June of 1783, Alexander Hamilton, in resolutions for a new constitution of the United States of America, set forth explicitly, quote, to emit an unfunded paper as the sign of value ought not to continue a formal part of the Constitution, nor ever hereafter to be employed, being in its nature pregnant with abuses and liable to be made the engine of imposition and fraud, holding out temptation equally pernicious to the integrity of government and to the morals of the people. These temptations were still being succumbed to in some of the states at the time Hamilton made his observations. Now, in New Jersey in 1783, they issued 31,250 pounds. In 1786, in New Jersey, an attempt was made to issue a larger amount. William Patterson, subsequently a member of our Supreme Court, resisted the proposal with words as follows. He said, an increase of paper money, especially if it be a tender, will destroy what little credit is left, will bewilder conscience in the mazes of dishonest speculation, will allure some and constrain others into the perpetration of knavish acts, will turn vice into a legal virtue, and sanctify iniquity by law. Men have, in the ordinary transactions of life, temptations enough to lead them from the path of recessitude. Why then pass laws for the purpose or give legislative sanction to positive acts of iniquity? Lead us not into temptation is a part of our Lord's Prayer, worthy of attention at all times, and especially at the present. In the summer of 1785, Richard Henry Lee, then President of Congress, warned Washington of a plan for issuing a large sum of paper money in the next assembly of their state, adding as his opinion, the greatest foes in the world could not devise a more effectual plan for ruining Virginia. I should suppose every friend to his country, every honest and sober man, would join heartily to reprobate so nefarious a plan of speculation. George Washington answered in August, "I have never heard, and I hope never shall hear, any serious mention of a paper emission in this state. Yet ignorance is the tool of design, and often set to work suddenly and unexpectedly." In that same year, George Mason wrote, "They may pass a law to issue paper money, but 20 laws will not make the people receive it. Paper money is founded upon fraud and knavery." On the 1st of August, 1786, George Washington wrote to Thomas Jefferson, "Other states are falling into very foolish and wicked plans of emitting paper money." Later in the year, the proposal to issue paper money was brought up in the House of Delegates of Virginia. Madison spoke as follows. He said, "Paper money is unjust. It is unjust to the creditors if a legal tender, to debtors if not a legal tender, by increasing the difficulty of getting specie. It is unconstitutional because it affects the rights of property as much as taking every equal value in land. It is pernicious, destroying confidence between individuals, discouraging commerce, enriching sharpers, vitiating morals, reversing the end of government, conspiring with the examples of other states to disgrace republican governments in the eyes of mankind." To Jabez Bowen of Rhode Island, Washington wrote of the 9th, or on the 9th of January, 1787, he said, "Paper money has had the effect in your state that it will ever have, to ruin commerce, oppress the honest, and open the door to every species of fraud and injustice." Now that's what our founding fathers thought about paper money. In the period between 1780 and 1787, when they actually wrote paper money right out of our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, prohibiting it. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, since that time, we have created banks and savings and loan companies and paper money. Our government is now issuing and making paper money. We have created the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, take a look around you at the economic calamities that are befalling the world by the use of paper money. Well, boys and girls, paper money isn't anything new. It's been around for thousands of years, and it's always had exactly the same end. Between 1692 and 1754, the people of the colonies indulged in paper money, and the losses that they suffered were 90%. They went back to specie in the 1750s, and then they deviated again, and between 1754 and about 1783, they lost it all again, and they lost about 90%. The history of paper money has been about the loss of 90% until we got to the present system of paper money. Now, the loss that we have suffered so far between 1930 and 2010 is 98%. So all we're really dealing with right now as I speak is the last two pennies of the money that we had in 1930. So if you lose everything that you've got now, all you've lost is 2 cents. That's all you're dealing with. However, it would be kind of good and good for you if you could hang on to that 2 cents or whatever portion thereof that you might be able to salvage between now and the final meltdown. So tuck it away in your heart and ask yourself the question, what can I do to salvage everything that I can as best I can right now? Now, as we have been discussing the richest nation in the world, we used to be, and then we started doing things, as George Washington pointed out here in his circular letter. He said, Remember, honesty will be found on every experiment to be the best and only true policy. Do you think Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan are acting honestly here? Do you believe that our government and our treasury, issuing $29.1 trillion to bail these banks out, these miscreants, and to perpetuate this paper money system, is doing you and I or anybody else any favors? Now, it would appear to me that my suggestion that we go back to the Ten Commandment model is pretty well placed. Now, I'm not an evangelist, and I'm not a preacher, a pope, or a prophet, and I'm not here to get you to give your heart to Jesus or to do anything that you wouldn't want to do. I just wanted to give you a suggestion that in that period of time when we actually practice this Ten Commandment model, using just weights and balances, gold and silver coin, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Between 1787 and 1933, boys and girls, we became the undisputed, richest, wealthiest nation on planet Earth. Not even the ancient Roman Empire had anything on us. But in 1933, we decided to make a turn to the left, and we made a pretty radical turn to the left, and what you see today is the results of what Franklin Roosevelt put into motion with the very first act of his administration, and that was to withdraw gold and silver, well, gold, not silver, but gold from the banking system, and to give us the beginnings of this fiat paper currency that we now have today. At that time, we had gold backing, we had silver coin, we had a low national debt. You know, we were, in fact, the richest nation in the world. We might have been involved in a depression. I wouldn't doubt it. We had jumped the tracks of sanity in 1913 and created this central bank, which drove us to bankruptcy in 1933. But you know, we could have paid those debts off. We, the American people at that time, we weren't insolvent. We were in financial distress, but not insolvent. Today, I showed you in the last program, we are totally insolvent. You and I, together. If we went to work on this problem today to pay off our debts, we can't do it. Now, there's a solution to this problem, and it's called a land Sabbath and Jubilee. You'll find it in Leviticus chapter 25. The solution nationally is to declare a jubilee, cancel the debts, and start over again. That was supposed to be done every 50 years. Now, you can rest assured that the Obama administration, the Republicans and Democrats, are not going to allow that to happen. You people in America, and indeed I'd say in Australia and Canada and Western Europe, you people are not going to go back to the Ten Commandment model, at least not on any national level. But you can go back to the Ten Commandment model on a personal, family, and individual level anytime you want. You Australians have gold and silver coin. You Canadians have it. We Americans have it. And most of you Europeans have it. And anytime that you want to go back to it, you can. Around the world, if your governments aren't printing or making gold and silver coin, you can get gold and silver coin from those who do. Gold and silver is available. In fact, you people in China, your government is encouraging you to buy gold and silver coin. I'm not sure about Japan, but anybody that wants to, at this juncture of time, if there's enough time left, could get into and out of paper money. You can get into gold and you can get out of paper. Now, what does that do when you get out of stock and bond markets? Well, the other day, we were watching the Nikkei over in Japan, and it dropped by 1,000 points. I think it was 1,200 points in about 3 or 4 days. Here in the United States, our stock market has had wild fluctuations over the past 10 years. And wild fluctuations of hundreds of points a day, wiping out your wealth. For instance, in the recession in 2000, 2001 and 2, we Americans, dabbling in our stock market, lost $7 trillion. Well, the stock market in 2008 and 2009 lost $9 trillion. Isn't that special? And each time it does that, then it goes back up. It's what they call the dead cat bounce. You take two steps forward and one back, two steps forward and one back. Only when the market turns against you, you take two steps back and one forward, two steps back and one forward. Well, in 1929, the market collapsed, and then it regained 60% of its value. And by 1930 and 31, people said, hey, things are cooking again. Hey, everything's fine. Then it turned around in 33 and it dropped off again, and the total loss between October of 1929 and March of 1933 was 89%. Well, in 2001 and 2, the government got it stopped with a $7 trillion loss and then moved the thing through the plunge protection team back up to about 14,000. It dropped down to about 6,500. They moved it back to 11,000, and now it's in the process of losing again. See, it takes about 3.5 years for this process to work its way out. So from September of 2008 to September of 2009, 10, 11, you could just about take yourself into the early months of 2012 before this thing is going to finally work itself out. So between now and then, whatever you've got is what you're trying to salvage. So why don't you tuck that one away in your heart and let's see where it goes. The richest nation in the world would have zero or near zero birth defects. That's what God tells us in Deuteronomy 28 verses 4 and 6. Do birth defects have a debilitating effect on a national economy? Well, everybody born with a birth defect has to have somebody to take care of him. He has a deformity, he has a disability. Now, maybe the disability is small, maybe the disability is large. For instance, if you've got cerebral palsy or autism, those are pretty serious defects. Now, here in America, we brag a lot and preach a lot about evolution and about the value of survival of the fittest. We don't practice what we preach and philosophize about. Because back in the 1990s, we enacted a law here called the American Disabilities Act. And now, we take great pride in putting our citizens into wheelchairs and feeding them drugs. But as a nation of people in wheelchairs and addicted to drugs, a candidate for the wealthiest nation on earth, does wealth come from wheelchairs and disabilities, sickness and disease? Do you know of any wealthy, sick, disabled people? Aren't most of those people on welfare and being taken care of by others? And every dollar that we have to spend taking care of all of these that are disabled, doesn't that take away from our standard of living? I don't think that a nation filled with people in wheelchairs and on drugs is a candidate for being the wealthiest nation on earth. How about banks? A nation with 13,000 banks lending to people and putting those people in debt to a level that they cannot pay off their debts. Is that an asset to the national economy or a disability? Because that's where we're at today. The banks are doing fine. And when the banks aren't doing fine, they privatize their profits and socialize their losses, and the people who have been ripped off by the banks then get to bail the banks out and pay off all their losses. Do you think that that's good for the nation? Is that the indice that you apply to the richest nation in the world? Then we have a nation that's filled with insurance companies. These insurance companies over here preach the doctrine of limited liability, that you don't want to be responsible for your own actions or your own debts. You want somebody else to do that, namely the insurance company. It's an opposition. It's in opposition to the strict liability statutes of the Scripture. The Bible requires, God requires, that we be financially responsible for our own actions. And we see that in, I think it's Exodus 21. Let me just flip over here quickly and see if that's true. Exodus 21, 28 through 36, I believe, is the statute. Let me see if I'm right. Exodus 21, 28 through 36. That's it. If an ox gores a man, in verse 28, or a woman that they die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. And it goes on to explain, it's called the negligence statute. The law of negligence requires the owner to be responsible for that ox, requires the owner to be responsible for his actions, and to pay those damages. Now we've turned into a nation that doesn't want to be responsible for our actions, we want somebody else to be. And when you do that, you create what's known as a guardian-ward relationship. So everybody who has an insurance policy is a ward of the insurance company. Just a little operation of law there. I didn't make it that way. I'm just reporting it to you. And then the insurance company gets to go to the legislature, and like they did here with the Obamacare bill, they said, hey, listen, if you want our support now for this Obamacare, this socialized medicine plan here for America, then you're going to have to give us what we want, and we want universal coverage. We want everybody to be covered by this plan so that we can sell insurance to everybody, whether they want it or not. We want everybody to be a customer, whether they want to or not. I'd like that. I'd like Congress to enact a law that requires everybody in America to buy at least one of my schools. Boy, would that make me a lot of money. It would take away your right to freedom of choice, but then what the hell do I care about your freedom of choice? I'm only interested in enriching myself. But you know, to be fair to everybody, don't you think then that instead of having compulsory education, compulsory insurance, compulsory auto insurance, compulsory health insurance, don't you think that the richest nation in the world would practice the right to private property and limited government so that people could choose for themselves what they wanted to buy, choose for themselves what they thought was in their best self-interest? Instead of having me choose your education for you, don't you think that maybe you should choose your education for yourself? Instead of me and a bunch of my cronies deciding for you the best education for your child, don't you think maybe you ought to choose the education for your own child? And instead of me and my cronies deciding for you what health care plan or how your health care plan should work, don't you think you should take care of your own health? Make your own decision. Now, I'm fully aware that many people are unable to do that. Those are called incompetent persons, and they have to have guardians. Well, people who have signed up for Social Security have a guardian. It's called the United States government. Those who have signed up for insurance have a guardian. Those are the insurance companies. And people who have bank accounts and checking accounts and credit cards, they have a guardian. And your legislators are making laws for you and regulating and controlling you because you've declared yourselves to be incompetent. When you sign up for that bank account, you're saying, in effect, this is the legal effect of your declaration here, I'm unable to manage my financial affairs and I need a guardian to do it for me. Some bad man's going to come along, take my money. I got to put it in the bank. I got to have somebody else count it for me. I'm not responsible for my actions. I need a guardian. I need somebody who can be responsible for me. And so the insurance company comes along and says, pay us the premium. We'll be responsible for your actions. Then they run right into the legislature and say, we need a seatbelt law. This guy hasn't got brains enough to wear his seatbelt. We need to lock him up in jail and punish him if he doesn't. We need an agent out on the highway over there, a guardian, to regulate and control his actions because he can't do it himself. Well, boys and girls, when people get to a point where they can no longer regulate their own actions, well, then somebody has to be appointed to do it for you. There was a kid the other day who was running around out on the ball field there in Philadelphia, and the security guards couldn't catch him. He was pretty fast, you know. He's a young kid, 18 years old, and he had a bunch of fat old men out here trying to catch him, and they couldn't. And so they tasered him. Well, you know, out of this ballpark, you know, there's 20, 30,000 people in the ballpark. Most of those people could govern, could control their actions. And they stayed in the stands and sat in their seats and watched the ball game. This one kid couldn't do that. He had to jump up and run out on the ball field and test and try out the security guards. And so the security guards then had to use what they considered, you know, the means by which we could control this guy. And so they used a taser. Oh, what a commotion that stirred up. Well, that sounds almost like lethal force. Well, I guess if you could, you know, if you got some wild animal out here and you can't catch him, typically we have to shoot him. I thought that the security guards did a pretty good job there. I don't know. If they couldn't catch him by hand, I guess then you got to bring him down, don't you? I've been out here trying to catch, you know, like you're trying to catch a coon or a possum. They're in your hen house killing chickens. And you know, have you ever run out there and tried to catch one of those coons by hand? I never have been able to do that. So I take a gun out there and I shoot them. And I take a bang stick out and extend my reach a little bit. Well, I just thought I'd throw that one out there for you. You know, insurance companies and banks and birth defects are not indice of the richest nation in the world. But God Almighty gives us 22 standards by which we could determine the richest nation on earth. And indeed, you people in Great Britain held this mantle for a couple of hundred years. And passed that mantle on to us about 1910. We've had it until about, oh, I guess, 1950. You could still say we were the richest nation in the world until 1950, maybe even 60. If you stretched it a little bit, maybe August 15th, 1971, when we repudiated gold. But we've been on the downhill slide from that point on, and we sure as hell don't meet the terms and conditions any longer. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. All right, let's see what else I've got here. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are taking a look here at the richest nation in the world. Remember a young woman on the Lehrer News Hour some years back, now be 2008, a couple of years ago, said America was the richest nation in the world, and it set my teeth on edge, and I thought to myself, where has this woman been? Has she been on Ork or someplace with Mork? Is she out of touch with reality? Well, I don't think she's alone. I think that most of the people of America are out of touch with reality. Believing that America is, in fact, the richest nation in the world, I guess, based upon our standard of living. I mean, if you're riding around in a Rolls Royce every day, you would tend to believe that I must be pretty wealthy. I'm driving a pretty fancy car. And I told you the other day about an old boy I knew down in Salt Lake City who was putting on the dog back in those days, 78, 79, 80, along in there, you know, just before that meltdown came, that real estate meltdown there in the early 80s. He was driving three Rolls Royces, and at that time they cost $105,000 apiece. I imagine they're double that now or more. But at that time, $100,000 was a lot of money, and he was living in a pretty splashy house, running a real estate brokerage company, doing pretty well for himself. And then one day, all of the cars were repossessed, his house was repossessed, and he filed for bankruptcy. He just flat-ass broke. Now, if we had been watching that fellow, we would have thought, well, now there's a pretty successful man, pretty wealthy fellow. And if you're looking at the average American today, you know, from where you're sitting in Nigeria, maybe, or maybe in Brazil or someplace, you people are probably sitting there saying, well, these Americans are pretty wealthy people. We act pretty wealthy. What it boils down to is that we're just a month or two away from being foreclosed on. We're in the process of being foreclosed on. We're losing our wealth. It's being taken away from us. We haven't lost it all yet. It hasn't all been taken away, but it's in the process of being taken away. And pretty shortly, it's going to be apparent that the Americans are naked, riding around on our big white horse, and we're flat-ass broke. Now, that's where reality's at. Now, our God, our Creator here, gave us a guideline here. Let me read you the 33 articulable benefits of the covenant. You'll find them in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, and Exodus 23. 33 of these benefits. Well, there's 32. I made a mistake, and I got one of them on here twice. Yeah, 32 articulable benefits. Listen to this list and see if there's anything on here that you could agree with, anything that you'd like to have. He starts off by saying, I'm going to give you rain in due season. The land shall yield her increase. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your stores of goods shall not run out. There will be no famine or shortages. You shall dwell in your land safely. I will give you peace in the land. I will rid evil beasts from the land. You shall have no war in your land. You shall chase your enemies. They shall fall before you by the sword. I will have respect unto you. I will make you fruitful and multiply you. I will establish my covenant with you. I will set my tabernacle among you. My soul shall not abhor you. I will be your God. You will be my people. You will be set above all nations on earth. You shall be blessed in the city. You shall be blessed in the fruit of your body. Blessed shall be the fruit of your cattle. Blessed shall you be when you come in and when you go out. You will be blessed in everything that you do. You will be a holy people unto God. All of the people of the earth will be afraid of you. You shall lend, but not borrow. You shall be the head, and not the tail, in all that you do. I will take sickness away from you. 70 years, all of your days will be fulfilled. You will inherit the land. You shall gain great wealth, multiplied gold and silver and herds and flocks. Now that sounds like a pretty good offer to me. That's called, in law, a tender offer. And that's what God made to the Israelites from up on top of Mount Sinai. He made a tender offer. And he said, this is what I'm going to give you, and here's what I want from you. Now, what we pay pay for something is called reciprocity. He said, I want this reciprocity, and he gave us 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, and he said, this is what I want you to do. And he outlined those in Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 28, verse 4, I believe it is, or 24, verse 8, excuse me. It's Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 24, verse 8. And he said, this is the reciprocity that I want for these 33 benefits. And in verse 7, I believe it was, the people, that is your great-great-granddaddy and mine and everybody else is standing there on that day, 84 generations back, said, all that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient. Now notice that one of these 33 benefits over here, he says, you'll be the head and not the tail in all you do. And he said, I'm going to set you on high above all the nations. I'm going to set my tabernacle above you. I'm going to establish my covenant with you. I'm going to set you on high above all the nations. That's in Deuteronomy 28, verse 1. Now, we Americans have been there, and I guess you could argue we're still there. Militarily, we're still the world's number one superpower, but economically, we're no longer the world's number one superpower. And our preeminence in finance and economics is being challenged. And indeed, I'm suspicious now that maybe the whole world's fiat currency system is being challenged. All right, now, based upon what we've seen so far, what we're witnessing here now is the penal clause to the contract being enforced. Because in the first 13 or 14 verses here of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, are what we call the benefits. It's called the tender offer. And then from verse 14, 15 on, he goes on to say, well, now here's what I'm going to do to you if you breach the contract. So in these the first 22 indici to the richest nation on earth, what we're seeing here is the effects of the breach of contract being visited upon us. Let me give you an illustration as to what a breach of contract is. Let's suppose that I'm a general contractor, and I come to you and I say, I'd like to remodel your kitchen. This is called a tender offer. I'm offering to remodel your kitchen. And you say to me, well, what do you want for reciprocity? And I say, I want $10,000. And then you say, well, what are the terms and conditions? What are you going to do for me? And I say, well, I'm going to put in new cabinets, new wiring, new plumbing, new light fixtures, new appliances, new floors. And you say, well, that sounds pretty good. Now, maybe in the terms and conditions, you say, well, I'm a little concerned about fire, and what I'd like you to do is to put number 10 wire in the wall. You put a little condition on there for me, and I say, okay. I'll put number 10 wire on the wall, but I can't do that for $10,000. I got to charge you $500 extra because number 12 is what the code calls for. And number 10 is pretty stiff wire, takes a little more time to put in. And so I'm going to charge $10,500, and you say, you're on. We sign the contract, and I go to work. We make our payments on time, and I do the work on time. Everything's going great. Finally, when we finish the job, I come to you for my final payment, and I say, now, Bob, I've finished the job, put in new cabinets, and I put in new wiring, plumbing, floors, appliances, and all that good stuff. And the price is $10,500. And now I want you to pay me my $10,500 balance. In other words, you've paid me some, but I want you to pay me the balance. Let's say it's a third, you know, $3,500 or so. And you say, now, let me check your work here, Mr. Gordon, and see what you've got done here. And so you take a screwdriver out, and you take off one of the wall plates, and you look inside, and you say, now, Mr. Gordon, look in there. Is that number 10 wire, or is that number 12? And I say, well, by golly, Bob, you're right. You know, that's number 12 wire. And our contract calls for a number 10 wire. And I say, I'm terribly sorry. I remember distinctly that you said you wanted number 10 wire. But, Bob, let me remind you that number 12 is what the code calls for. And I have delivered you the certificate of occupancy. And the building inspector, plumbing inspector, and the electrical inspector have all signed off on these permits, and they have approved the work that has been done here, and it meets the National Electrical Code, National Plumbing Code, and the state and electrical and plumbing code and building codes, and this job has been done perfectly, approved by everybody. And you say, George, I want you to rip out all of this number 12 wire, and I want you to replace it with number 10 wire, or I'm not going to pay you what I owe, and then on top of that, I'm going to sue you for the breach of contract. And then I'm going to ask for all of my money that I've paid back, and then to teach you to suck eggs, I'm going to sue you for punitive damages of an equal amount. So not only do I want you to give me my $10,500 worth of kitchen remodel, I want you to pay me $10,500 to do it. Plus, I want you to give me $10,500 in addition to that to punish you for having lied to me and cheated me. I mean, Bob, you know you're really getting to be obnoxious, and I point that out to you. And I say, let's go to litigation. Now, when we go to litigation, what do you think's going to happen? Who do you think's going to win, Bob? You or me? I mean, after all, you got to admit, it's done to code. You got the CO, and you got all of the permits signed off. Well, I'm sorry to report this, but in the final analysis, little Georgie Gordon's going to lose, and probably big time. Probably the court's going to give you all of the remedies that you're seeking, and they might even instruct me to go back in there, rip out all that wiring, and make those repairs. Or perhaps even have to compensate you for the value of your home, because now that it doesn't have the number 10 wire on the wall, you probably could never have a decent night's sleep from that point on, maybe. I don't know. Just throwing that out there to you, but I can tell you that that's what breach of contract is. It's really bad. When you make a deal with somebody and then you renege on the deal, it oftentimes just has awful, god-awful, tough consequences. All right, now let's go back here to our old covenant. We made a deal. You didn't, and I didn't, but your great-great-great-great-granddaddy did. And my great-great-great-great-granddaddy did. And they showed up out there, and they said, hey, all that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient. And then time went by, and you and I are heirs and assigns forever. You know what that means? That means that you and I picked up on that kitchen and the wiring in the house, we inherited that. All these benefits, we inherited. And now we have to perform on that contract, and we haven't been doing that. And so in verse 14, God goes on to say here in Leviticus 26, he says, "But if you will not hearken unto me, and if you will not do all of these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgment so that you will not do all of my commandments, but that you break my covenant, I also will do this unto you. I will appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it." Now, here in America, have you noticed that our enemies around the world eat our soybeans, wheat, and corn? We sow our seed. See, we go out and borrow money from our bankers, pay them interest and usury. Then we sell this stuff to ConAgra and ADM, who in turn put it on the train, ship it to New Orleans, and load it on ships and send it off to Odessa, Russia, so that our enemies can eat it. Have you noticed that? We have less food now in the United States than we need to feed ourselves. We're importing food from outside our borders, which isn't a very good security plan in my view. And he says, "I'm going to set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies, and they that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when none pursues." You ever notice that the IRS rules over us and we flee from them? Terrorized by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, the Franchise Tax Board, the IRS, OSHA. Come on. Wake up and smell the coffee here. These guys come in here and run roughshod over us, and you know as well as I do. Then we flee from them in terror, scared of them. Hasn't always been that way, but that's what's developed now since we changed. That is, you and I, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives out here, we changed from the Ten Commandment model to the Ten Plank model. Things haven't been quite the same for us, have they? In verse 25, he says, "I'm going to bring a sword upon you," that's war, "and I'll avenge the quarrel of my covenant." Do you know what the quarrel of a covenant is? I'm going to avenge your breach of contract. I'm going to exact the penal clause to our contract. "And when you're gathered together within your cities, I'm going to send the pestilence among you, and you shall be delivered into the hands of your enemies." Now, we're all sitting here waiting for this H1N1 flu or Ebola. We're gathered together in all of our cities by our tens of millions now, waiting for the axe to fall, aren't we? Everybody tells us, you know, that one of these days we're going to have one of these big plagues. There's prima facie the evidence. Your God, your Creator Himself says, "That's what I'm going to do to you." It ain't a question of if, it's just a matter of when. When's that going to happen? He says He's going to do it to you. And then, verse 26, "When I have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women shall bake your bread in one oven, and they shall deliver you your bread again by weight, and you shall eat and not be satisfied." You ever take some of these verses and then translate them into modern English? See, that's what the old King James says, and it's a little bit stiff. Let me translate that one for you. In verse 26, he says, "And when I have broken the staff of your bread, 10 women working for ITT bakeries shall bake your bread in one block-long oven, and they shall deliver you your wallpaper paste again by weight in 1 pound loaves, and you shall eat that white death and not be satisfied because it has no nutritional value in it." That's what that's telling you. And then they advertise that on TV and they say, "Wonder Bread builds strong bodies 12 ways. And then God says, that these 10 women are going to bake you your bread in this big one-block-long oven and deliver you this bread in one-pound loaves, and you'll eat that wallpaper paste and not be satisfied because there's no nutritional value in it. And he says, if you will not, for all of this, hearken unto me, and after I do this to you, if you won't shape up, but if you walk contrary to me, then I'm going to walk contrary unto you also, and in fury. And I, even I, will chastise you 7 times for your sins. I'm going to punish you 7 times more for the violation of the terms of our contract. So when I looked at that, I said, uh-oh. I think maybe I better adhere to the terms and conditions of our deal. You know, a deal's a deal. And boys and girls, we made this deal. Now, your preacher should be explaining this deal to you on Sunday mornings. I don't know what your preacher's telling you when you go in there, but he should be explaining to you these terms and conditions because the old man's getting upset with us. I saw a bumper sticker the other day. It said, Jesus is coming. And boy, is he pissed. Yeah, I'd say, you know, based upon what I'm reading here, you might want to write this down. This is Leviticus 26. I didn't write this. Don't get mad at me now. I'm just a reporter, just reporting. Leviticus chapter 26 starts about verse 14. Then the other one's in Deuteronomy 28, and that's the other penal clause chapter. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, and he says, now listen up, boys and girls, because if you don't cure this breach of contract now, here's what I'm going to do. And it's already underway. This economic meltdown now, this is just getting leaned on 7 times. We need to get reformed as soon as possible. We need a reformation here. The religious guys, they call it, these evangelists, they want repentance. And they come out and they evangelize. Oh, they got a word for that. I'll think of it here in a minute. But anyway, they want you to be revived. They call it a revival. That's what it is. They call it a revival. They want you to be revived. So, God's telling you here, you know, he says he's going to make your land desolate. I'm going to bring the land into desolation. Hey, out there in the west where you've only got 5% of your water in the Central Valley, and you're suffering from 10 years of drought, we haven't got to the worst part yet, but it's bad now, and it needs to be straightened out. And all we need to do here now is straighten out this contract. We need to perform on our half of the deal. And as soon as we start performing on our half of the deal, we're going to see about 90% of these problems disappear suddenly. They'll just evaporate. But if we don't cure this breach over here, we're going to find ourselves in heavy-duty litigation. So I just thought I'd bring that to your attention. Now write this down, boys and girls. It's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. They're called the penal clause chapters of the covenant. The covenant, now remember, is located in Exodus 19. That's Exodus chapter 19. Starts in verse 16. And it carries through to Exodus chapter 24, verse 8. So that's Exodus 19, 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. There's the terms and conditions of the deal. Now look in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, first 13, 14 verses. Put that story together and that'll tell you, here's the contract and here's the breach. Hey, I'm running out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.